Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR. Sirius XM, channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
When you ask about him, what are you asking about?
Well, I was asking, how did my dad get hurt?
How do you hope that the world remembers him?
Well, they helped him because those mean people did something to him.
Yeah. If you could say anything to your daddy right now, what would it be?
It would be, I miss you and I love you.
That seven-year-old, Gianna Floyd, the daughter of George Floyd, during the victim impact statement portion of Derek Chauvin's criminal sentencing, the former Minneapolis police officer going to prison for 22 and a half years for the murder of George Floyd 13 months ago today. Well, tonight we examine the sentencing and the broader issues about race and the justice system. And we begin tonight with Justin Hansford, Executive Director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at Howard University School of Law, and trial lawyer J. Wendell Gorton. Lines are open. I want to know what you think about the sentencing today at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Tweet me at HFisher, WHUR, or follow me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Jay, Justin, thank you both for joining the conversation.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Jay Wendell here.
Let me start with this heart-wrenching victim's impact statement from Gianna Floyd. Justin, who is that for? Because this is not for, there was no jury present here. This was a sentencing. The decision was up to the judge. Was that for the public, the judge, what?
For Justin or for Jay Wendell?
Justin, please.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so first of all, thanks for having me again,
sure.
Harold. Always glad to be here. I think that was a really a heartbreaking statement that would be something that was designed to, yes, have the judge take into consideration the heinousness of the act. But this trial, this is something for the ages. This is something that will always be in our collective memory. And I think that voice, that young person's story with, you know, that young person's life will be forever changed. And I think the more important impact of that voice is the impact that it has on us to know that this is who we're fighting for when we're fighting for police reform. These are real people, real families, real children whose lives are being affected. And I hope that the audience included people on Capitol Hill and people in Congress who need to move on these police reform bills as soon as possible.
Jay Wendell, do you think this sentence of 22 years and 5 months was the appropriate sentence?
Well, let me first say that was well stated, Justin. I appreciate what you said about the young people who we fight for. Was it appropriate? It was within the bounds of the law. However, I don't think we will see anytime soon a case more egregious than the George Floyd case where it's caught on motion pictures. You know what I mean? So I felt as though what would be most appropriate, or at least appropriate in my view, would be a maximum sentence. And if it was 30 years, he deserved all 30. However, I think in some respects, the judge wanted to fit the baby. You could see when he came out to the bench, he had that long opinion as to his sentence. So he made his decision some time ago. It really didn't matter what anyone said during their a victim impact statement or in the mitigation, his decision was made. It's going to be 22.5, given 10 additional years for the aggravating circumstances that he found. Nonetheless, I'm not going to, if it was us, we would have gotten the maximum. he should get the maximum. The gentleman who, the other officer, the black officer who killed a woman and got less and was convicted of far less than Derek Chauvin got 12 years. So this guy, he got 22.5, of which he'll do about 14.85 is my calculation.
Why do you say that?
Because they do 2/3 of their sentence, you know, provide, you know, good time. There are various opportunities that an inmate has to reduce his sentence. He could work, he could double bunk, have cell buddy. There are just multiple things you can do to have your sentence reduced. And then you come up for parole. So I believe in 14.85 months, I'm sorry, in years, he'll be up for parole.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is the part that happens behind the curtain that nobody really knows about. And then the lawyers can come around and file a motion for reconsideration and have the judge hold it sub curia for about 3 to 4 to 5 years, and the judge could adjust the sentence even at that point if he figures that he's doing well in jail, performing well adjusted, you know, maybe he started a Christian service group or something of that nature. So there are a lot of opportunities to have your sentence reduced. So I was rather kind of nonplussed by the sentence that was handed down by the judge. But to me, anything under the maximum, it wasn't enough.
Justin, based on what Jay Wendell just shared with us, is that justice?
I think very, very few people would believe that is justice, especially seeing that video that outraged the entire world. I think it's a difficult question to answer because we are also in the context of a criminal legal system that you know, we're already talking about mass incarceration and the sentences that are given and the parole process, which really relies on a lot of discretion given to these parole boards as to when people are released. And oftentimes, especially with folks who are black and brown, you know, we see the measures of contrition or things like that really being in the eye of the beholder. But I think for most folks who have been fighting for police reform, this is not justice. Even though the sentence was above what people expected as, in line with the sentencing guidelines, many people in the advocacy community, the ACLUs, NAACP, Legal Defense Fund, people like that, have almost in unison said that this is not justice. What we need is ultimate reform. We need to do something to make sure that this doesn't happen again on a systemic level. One bad apple being punished does not change the overall structure of systemic injustice here.
I want to talk about that as well. But for right now, I definitely want to stick to what happened in the courtroom today. And I want both of you, starting with Jay Wendell, to react to this. First of all, Derek Chauvin's mother and Chauvin himself.
Derek, I want you to know I have always believed in your innocence, and I will never waver from that. I have read numerous letters from people around the world that also believe in your innocence.
I do want to give my condolences to the Floyd family. There's going to be some other information in the future that would be of interest. And I hope things will give you some peace of mind. Thank you.
I will say, Jay Wendell, that what we heard from Derek Chauvin's mother did not surprise me. That's kind of what mothers do. But the thing that I found, for lack of a better term, strange was Chauvin's very, very brief comments. Your thoughts about that first?
Chauvin's comments?
Yeah, both of them.
Well, I was taken aback by the mother. In fact, after listening to her, you see how Derek Chauvin ended up being the monster that he is today. This woman showed no compassion.
Mm-hmm.
for the family that lost their loved one at the hands of her beloved son. And she's saying that her son won't do well in jail and that she would be serving time with him because he won't do well, she'll be serving time with him. I just feel like, okay, I don't care. And maybe you do need to be in jail for raising such a monster, because George Floyd and his family will not get a chance to see him again. He's gone forever. All he is now is a memory, a couple of hashtags, and someone who left a legacy for the world. But nonetheless, he's gone. And for her to say these things and not even express any condolences to the family. And you know what she said when she got up there? I represent the family of Derek Chauvin. So she wasn't just speaking for herself as a mom. Mm-hmm. She's speaking for the entire Klan. So, I was really offended by her comments, and they were probably better off not said. And no, I don't expect that. Even a mother who's seen her son do the things to someone who Derek Chauvin did to George Floyd, you have to have some degree of compassion. But see, they don't see the humanity in African Americans. She missed that completely. And so we understand why Derek Chauvin is being called all the things he's being called. He's being called a racist, and apparently to white people, it's far worse to actually be called a racist than to actually be a racist. And I don't know why that is. It's a phenomenon to me. But it's far worse to be called a racist than to actually be one. But Derek Chauvin showed who he really was in that video. And I think either his mother was on some Percocets or dope, because she, I just did not appreciate her commentary at all. And I didn't see it as mitigating at all. In fact, I saw her mother as an aggravating factor.
Mm-hmm. Justin, before I go to the phone lines, your thoughts either about what Chauvin's mother said or what Chauvin said, which, as I said, I just found it surprising, almost to the point where I thought it probably would have been best if he had not said anything at all.
Yeah, I couldn't say that better than Jay Wendell said it. No compassion shown on the mother's behalf. At least Chauvin, at this late date, was able to express some sort of wishes to George Floyd's family, but nothing at all from the mother. And so I think Jay Wendell said it best here. It just shows why he became the man he became Derek Chauvin, and explains a lot in terms of the context.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are examining the Derek Chauvin sentencing today for the murder of George Floyd. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. Let me quickly go to Calvin, calling from D.C. What's on your mind, Calvin? Quickly.
My best thing is that they shouldn't have said nothing at all. My grandmother used to say, if you ain't got nothing good to say, hey, don't say nothing at all. I led three of the Black Lives Matter movements downtown when we were walking from the White House at Lafayette Square all the way up to the Capitol. So I know what we was doing. I know the type of nationality were there. It wasn't just black folks. So I know we all were sticking together in that. So to hear that this is going on with Derek Chauvin, and we watching that video, and you sitting up here, got an ambulance coming with a police officer getting out. It's not a medic. We see your cuffs on your waist. We see your bulletproof vest. Medics don't wear that. You know what I'm saying? We saw all that on the video. See, and so what it got me doing is I'm talking with the chief police now, Robert Conti, because I'm trying to get this job working out there at Blue Plains with recruiters. I want to let them know the difference between crime and crisis, because I have a mental illness.
Okay.
They have hit me with rubber bullets. They have hit me with tasers. They have 40 on 9mm on me when I was hurt.
Well, Calvin, look, thank you so much for your comments. I appreciate your passion. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are examining the sentencing of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd. J. Wendell Gordon, thank you so much for your comments. We're going to hang in here with Justin Hansford as we take a quick break. But don't forget, you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insights segment via podcast on WHUR.com. Don't forget to download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live. If you're on the phone, stay with us, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We will take your calls. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. I'm Harold Fisher. Angela Stribling is in for John Mons. And she's next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. This discussion continues in just a few seconds. Welcome back to the Daily Drum on SiriusXM, Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. We continue our discussion about the sentencing of convicted murderer Derek Chauvin for the killing of George Floyd. This happening 13 months ago today in Minneapolis, Minnesota. We continue this conversation with Justin Hansford, Executive Director of the Thurgood Marshall Civil Rights Center at Howard University School of Law. Also joining the conversation now, Debbie Hines, trial lawyer and former Baltimore City prosecutor. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Debbie, your thoughts about how today ended. You are you're a former prosecutor, I should say, and you have seen the best and the worst in a courtroom. Your thoughts about today?
So I was disappointed in hearing the outcome of the verdict of 22 and a half years, and I was explaining it this way. He was seeing a maximum of 40 years. That's the most that Chauvin could have received from the judge, and the guidelines added up to basically substantially less than the 40 years, and the defense wanted, oh my God, time served or probation, which was never going to happen. But the prosecutors asked for 30 years, which I thought was reasonable. But when you ask me about my experience prosecuting in the city, and I prosecuted first-degree murders and second-degree murders, you know, I've seen judges not bat an eye at giving a black defendant the maximum. And in Maryland, the maximum for second-degree murder is 30 years, regardless of what the guidelines say. So I just felt that with this case, from what we saw, the thing that everyone knows that makes this case be so different from any case that I've prosecuted, most people have ever prosecuted, or defense attorneys have ever tried, is the fact that it was all caught on video. We weren't relying on he said, she said, and what people thought they saw. We were looking at, everyone around the world looked at what was seen. And a judge has to apply the facts of the case within the law, looking at the aggregating factors, and yes, looking at the mitigating factors. Chauvin was a police officer, so he did not have a record before, and that would be a mitigating factor. But the aggregating factors were so extreme, and those are the factors that allows a judge to give more time, which he did, than the guidelines. The factors that, you know, he abused his position of trust, so that goes against him never having been arrested again before. There was an act of cruelty. I mean, to say the least, it was an act of cruelty, and that it was done with three other people and with a child in presence. So the judge had the factors, the aggravating factors, that would have allowed him to give the time that the prosecutors were seeking, which was 30 years. And bear in mind, that was 10 years less than what he could have gotten under the maximum. So the judge ended up giving him 7.5 years less than what the prosecutor gave after they had already shaved off 10 years of time. So yes, I was disappointed. And it just goes to show that in a lot of these instances, and this is the research has proven this, that when it is a black victim, that a defendant, be it white or black, is not given, you know, as much time as when it would be a white victim. And I think everyone knows from experience that have encountered anything within the criminal justice system that if Chauvin were black, he would have gotten, if Chauvin were black and George Floyd was white, he would have gotten every bit of at least the 30 years. And so that is my outrage, because I just have seen judges just not bat an eye for a murder case, maybe not for every case, but for a murder case, not even think twice about it. And in this case, the thing that makes it so different than most murders that we see that are tried in city courtrooms is most murders are usually most times involving an act of a gun. And not to take away from a victim who's been killed with gunfire, but a gun is very quick. You're not going to, you know, end up putting bullets in someone for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. So that's the whole piece of it that I think makes it, you know, difficult for me to swallow, but it does give the family something. I'm glad he did not get what the guidelines were calling for, so he did get more than that. But in reality, he served two-thirds of the sentence if he is on good behavior. So those 22 and a half years, if he is on good behavior, really chopped down to 15 years. But there's always a silver lining, because he is facing more time, because he has two federal cases that are ahead of him that he will be arraigned on in September. And so that's the silver lining. I want people to know that it's not over.
You took the words right out of my mouth when you were talking about the torture of George Floyd versus if he had been shot. And I agree that you gave this particular horrific crime the context, which is not to in any way, shape, or form suggest that all of the other circumstances being the same, if George Floyd had been shot, perhaps the sentencing, you know, would have been, some may say, more appropriate at, say, 22.5 years. But this was torture. This was, and the, I like the word you used, this was cruelty. This was a slow motion death. And nothing, I don't think, can be more horrific than someone being, you know, tortured to death, on top of the fact that even if we hear crimes like that, and you know as a prosecutor, the public may hear that someone has been tortured to death, but you don't see it.
Yet.
And we saw it. And I think your point was right on the mark. Let me go to the phone lines, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Bill, calling from Maryland. Thanks for hanging on, Bill. What's on your mind?
Yes, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Jay Wendell made a point that, quite frankly, I had not thought of. The cruelty of that mother. Mm. You know, my mother loved me, but there's no way my mother would have come on and tried to justify that kind of behavior. I expect the mother somewhere to be sympathetic about it. I hadn't given it much thought until Jay mentioned it. I guess she did create a monster.
Mm. Good point, Bill. Thank you so much. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Diane, calling from Maryland. What's on your mind, Diane?
Yeah, I agree with the last caller. When I looked at George Floyd kill this man and the look on his face, he's probably done this before. He just got caught. We caught this on camera. But for his mother to have no remorse says a whole lot about him. That's why he probably had the look on his face. He felt justifiable to kill a black person. And it was murder, and it was torture. And we had dinner just now, and I want to bet. I said he's going to get no more than about 15 years, because this has already been decided behind the scenes. Because the system is just not designed for black people. The rules are for us, not for them. Straight up, that's what it is. And they're letting us know that. That's a slap in the face. To witness a murder on national TV, undeniably, and the judge gives him that sentence.
Diane, thank you so much for your comments. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Justin, America and indeed the world has felt the palatable shock of this murder and the emotionally debilitating feeling that waiting on this case and the trial has taken on the American psyche and indeed the world. But how long do you believe that will last, and what do you think are the long-term implications? Because as we know, the public has a short memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a heavy question. You know, we talk about the emotional impact on all of us in the aggravating factors. The judge took into consideration that there were children present. Of course, if we were going to go to the truth of the matter, there were thousands, maybe millions of children who might have had to see that, and adults who had to see that around the world. So the emotional impact, just waves of grief, and you know, there's impact from the subsequent protests, and people have been indelibly marked by their own personal experiences. I think it's 26 million people went out to demonstrate in the summer of 2020. So the long-term impact, I believe, will be a combination of what people had to see on TV, but also what people experienced in the subsequent weeks and months. And I do think that that's going to stay with people. I don't know if we're going to get the federal legislation that we want in the short term. But I do think that if you look at the opinion polls, people have changed the way they view the legal system as a result of what happened to George Floyd. And that can lead to many small changes in smaller jurisdictions around the country. We've seen changes here in the state of Maryland has had reforms, D.C. So I think we're going to see things happen, and probably in ways that we won't even be able to track ultimately in terms of conversations and the changing of people's minds. And maybe over the long term, that's how we get to more justice.
Debbie, we may not necessarily see the impact of this case codified, but might we see hearts and minds changed in the courtrooms when it comes to prosecutors, judges, and others who work day in and day out when it comes to the American justice system?
Well, I think that what we will see is hopefully chief prosecutors, DAs, state attorneys who will run for office who will be progressive, because change happens at the top in a prosecutor's office. If you are a line prosecutor like I was, I didn't run in office, then I have to follow the protocol of the office. And in a lot of the prosecutorial offices and DA's offices across the country, they side with the police. That is the very reason why these police officers are not charged, not only for murder, but for any type of excessive force case. So what I want to say to people out there is you have to pay attention to prosecutors who are progressively seeking an office as prosecutors, or who are already in office doing the job of a progressive prosecutor and trying to make these changes. And you have to go out and support them and keep them in office and vote them in office, because that's where the change comes, to the prosecutor's office. And as far as judges that have a lifetime appointment for the most part, you know, in many of these instances, they either have a 15-year appointment or a 20-year appointment, which in essence ends up being, you know, their lifetime on a bench. So there's not that much you can do, I don't think, when that end. And basically, I think that the end is on the prosecutorial end. But I do want to give a shout out to Maryland, because the sweeping legislation that Maryland had in terms of police reform is of the highest so far in the country. And so that is how the other change comes about. It's, you know, but Maryland, at least for right now, has a progressive legislation and legislators that were able to get this passed. And so, you know, I emphasize social activism and activism, which got us to this point, but I also emphasize the vote.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Michael, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, sir. First thing I want to do, man, is give you honors, man, for putting the issues, man, that we need to be looking at and dealing with, man, on the forefront.
Thank you.
And I'm looking at this man like this. You know, it's like, okay, they sentenced this man, and everybody is applauding that he got 20-something years or whatever, but there is an appeal process. There is an appeal process, man, that has been and is been hidden from us, man. If we look at this trial, we see that his lawyer didn't really present anything. They really didn't do anything. And I'm saying, in terms of the appeal process, that's something, man, that we're not privy to. We're not seeing. They might tell us, okay, well, he is granted an appeal and put out on bond or whatever. But on the grand scheme of things, man, the outcome, man, we never afforded that. And I'm gonna give you a perfect example.
Real quick, go ahead, Michael.
The lady that killed the boy that supposedly went in his apartment, I think it was in Texas or something.
Yes.
She is on appeal. We heard nothing about that, man, and I'm just done with it.
Well, let me say this, and I invite both Debbie and Justin to chime in with this. We already know that Derek Chauvin plans on appealing his conviction. He has already been denied retrial, but help me here, Debbie, because you know my law school education goes only as far as this program. Okay. With that said, the judge denies a new trial, but he still has the right to appeal, does he not?
Yeah, everybody that's convicted, generally, as far as I know, appeals their, if they get convicted in their sentence, generally everybody is appealing, filing a motion to appeal their sentence. So that is just how, that's just normal. Of course he would appeal, and they will write briefs, and an appellate court will hear. From what I heard and saw in the trial, I don't really think there that would be overturned, which is the word, overturned on appeal. You know, an appeal is not based on, I don't like how things turned out. An appeal, it flips. And the appeal means that the convicted defendant now has to prove what was wrong. And that what was wrong, you know, violated his constitutional rights.
Yeah.
And the judge pretty much leaned over backwards to allow the defense what they wanted to do. So I don't see that really getting anywhere.
Mm. Go ahead, Justin.
Yeah, I would love to hear Debbie's view on this because I'm not a trial attorney. There was a discussion around the fact that one of the jurors may have attended a protest, and there had been talk that that might be a basis for an appeal, and that's what they were preparing to argue. I'm not sure what you think about that possibility as being a sound basis for arguing that the juror had some sort of bias that was demonstrated by going to a protest.
Right. So what they were, what the jurors were asked when voir dire was one of the questions was, had anyone attended any of the George Floyd protests? And that juror that you're speaking to said truthfully, no. What he had attended was the, every year, and there's one coming up now, he had attended in Washington the march that generally Al Sharpton puts together, which is in August, usually the end of August, to commemorate the March on Washington.
Yeah, the March on Washington. Yeah, for justice and civil rights.
Yes. March on Washington for justice. And so that is what he attended. That march was not a George Floyd protest. it was a march on Washington. Of course, George Floyd and everyone spoke about it, and he was there. And I think that juror had a had a T-shirt on about Black Lives, but he didn't violate anything that was asked of him. He was asked had he attended any George Floyd marches, and he did not. But to your question on appeal, when I said it's just not a matter of raising issues. Even if that were so, you have to show how that harmed you, how your constitutional rights were violated. And if that hadn't happened, this wouldn't have happened and you wouldn't be in jail. Yeah. And that really makes it be a really, really hard burden. The thing that most cases can get overturned on usually have more to do with the judge gave jury instructions and that jury instruction was really in violation of the law or really wasn't stated correctly. But, you know, what Maxine Waters said, what this juror did, the fact that the case was not removed to another county, those are all issues that will probably be raised. But then again, you have to show now that you raised it, how did that harm you? And you have to prove that, not just you're saying, if I had been in another county instead of, you know, Minneapolis, this wouldn't have happened. But no, I think and that was one of the reasons why the judge denied the motion for new trial. I think that was concluded within the motion for new trial. But that juror answered the question that was posed to him correctly.
Justin, one of the things that we have seen since the murder of George Floyd was reform in the Minneapolis Police Department. Even if the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act or anything similar to it is not codified, is not made law on a federal level, do you believe that there is a possible trickle-down effect through police departments, big and small, as a result of this?
You know, I actually do think that there's a trickle-down effect. I would not necessarily assume that now police who are going to use force are going to be thinking about Derek Chauvin. You know, in the immediate aftermath of the conviction, we saw another case right there in Minneapolis, and we saw a number of cases around the country. I do think, though, the trickle-down effect could happen on the city level. You know, you would think that perhaps with the possibility of convictions and also very influential would be the civil claim, which you would think that the possibility of liability, which cities almost always indemnify police officers, meaning that the millions of dollars that went to the Floyd family didn't come out of Derek Chauvin's pocket. It came from the city's coffers. You would think that cities would take that into consideration and consider the fact that with a different environment rising, and I do want to mention, this is only the 10th murder conviction in the last 20 years for a police officer killing a civilian, and we have over 1,000 police killings of civilians every year. So it's incredibly rare. So it's a wing and a prayer that these will be factoring the possibility of these outcomes, these convictions, or these civil liability claims when they design policy. But I do think that the cultural shift, the conversations that have had the protests, I do think that the trickle down effect on the local level from those activities has been significant and hopefully will continue to be significant in the future.
Do you believe, Debbie, that there will be a chilling effect as it relates to police and community relations, or do you believe that this is a wake-up call for police departments for them to continue with, you know, cultural competence, different kinds of training, and trying to weed out, any signs of racism or bias in police departments and rank and file officers.
Okay, so I hate to be the pessimist here, but
you'll do your thing.
No, I don't see it changing that way. I don't think the police departments are so embedded with culture, and that goes with white, black, brown, any police officer. That's what we're talking about. The culture is there, and I don't think it's just going to just have a wake up that we're just going to change. I think that the change has to be, again, through the law changing. And I use Maryland as the example because one of the laws that will pass July 1st, but that was voted on during the last General Assembly, has to do with a change in the law on excessive force by police and adding in a new criminal charge that an officer under certain circumstances would be subject to 10 years in jail. That's the change. Mm. The change is not just going to happen because of what happened to George Floyd. I don't think people's hearts in the police department are going to change any more than I think, and I hate to put it this way, that would be like saying that white supremacists are going to change because they saw what's happening to black people. I don't, that's the same concept, but I think that that's where the law is important. And I go back to getting in progressive lawmakers and progressive prosecutors. That's what has to change. Because all these verdicts that are going, I mean, all these settlements that are going out, which I hope people understand, that's your taxpayers' money. That is, so in essence, George Floyd was paying for part of his, you know, part of his family's settlement. It's not that the money is in the police coffers. The police coffers go to the Board of Estimates. They request the money that they will need, and the money is already in their budget for paying out for excessive force cases. So how is that going to change? So that's what I'm saying. I don't see it changing on the police end. It has to be, you know, we have to make them do good. And that has to be done through prosecutors prosecuting and lawmakers passing laws.
Debbie, what impact do you believe that today's sentencing and indeed the overall trial will have, if any, on the other three officers involved in the murder of George Floyd?
If I were the other three officers, I would be giving serious thought to a plea bargain, because while we're, you know, saying that on the one hand, 22 and a half years wasn't really a lot of time, they're facing the same amount of time for their aiding and abetting. I mean, they're facing the same, basically the same time, whether they would get it or not. So I think if I were representing the other officers, I would be trying to see if I could get a plea bargain that would tie up with a nice neat bow the federal case that they're facing, that they'll be arraigned on in September, as well as the state case, which is a parallel to the Derek Chauvin case that we just got sentenced on, which I think is going to be in March. If they want to roll the dice, as we say, and go to trial, I think that they should understand that they're probably going to get jail time.
Hmm. I only have a few minutes left. Your final thoughts about today, Justin, and where today's sentencing moves us when it comes to race and the criminal justice system?
I think that today's sentencing gives us similar to the conviction, it gives us a sense that things are shifting. I think that we spent many years, especially since the Mike Brown, Trayvon Martin, meaning people who are searching for police reform, our community, feeling like there was no hope. And I think for many people, it was important to see the conviction. It was important to see amount of time that was given that even went beyond the sentencing guidelines. But ultimately, I agree with Debbie. I think that we have not reached a point where there's going to be change that results because of the conviction or because of the sentencing or because of the liability claim, especially with qualified immunity being what it is. And for folks who are continuously in the crosshairs of this system, people who get convicted for, you know, drug crimes, and you know there are black people in jail for a lot longer than 50 years for things a lot less violent and heinous. So there's a lot that we still have to do. I'm hoping that the push for change continues, and I'm hoping that this is an inspiration for people to feel like there is movement, there is something that is pushing us in the right direction. We're not even beginning to get close to the policy change we want to get to, but at least there's hope.
Debbie Hines, Justin Hansford, thank you both so much for participating in the conversation. We also want to thank J. Wendell Gordon for being part of the conversation earlier. We appreciate it. And of course, this issue will not go away. We will continue to watch. That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Friday, June 25th. For News Director Renee Nash, reporters Millette Green, Bramante Bryant, producer Candace Atkins, and engineer Bobby Adams, I'm Harold Fisher. Now stay tuned for Unheard. Good night and have a wonderful weekend.